Tonight on The Download, the author of the new book, Rocket Men, Robert Kersen. The writer and director of the new film, Book Club, Bill Holderman. And live music in Studio 435 from Brandon Fox. Now, here's your host, a man who was stuck in the middle of iced or regular coffee today, Justin Kaufman.
Don't you love the days when it's cold and humid?
Sure, rad.
Yeah, I had a hard time today, Pete. I was like, do I start my iced coffee run? You know, we get some coffee going around 4 o'clock, and we get the prep started, and we get everything going. It's like a machine. It's like, if you've seen the broadcast news, that's me and Pete. Just me and Pete. Before showtime. But yeah, I'm at that point where I'm not sure what to do. It's cold, yet it's warm. Maybe one ice cube? I have a problem because I cut out, and nobody cares about this, but I cut out cream, right? It was one thing I did, get the health in check. So I go with the 2% milk or skim milk. So when I go to Dunkin' Donuts now for the iced coffee, and I want it, I always have to say to them, I don't want that cream, because they just do the pump. It's like straight up, that's straight up cholesterol. They're just like, and I'm like, hey, can I get milk? And they're like, oh, yeah. And then they give you milk, but I don't know. That to them means no milk. I don't know why. The amount of milk they put in is
nothing.
A little
splash.
Yeah, so I'm just like, this is not working for me, so I have to figure that out. I think I need to do, maybe I can get Dunkin' Donuts to do what Starbucks is doing for training, where they, you know, Starbucks is taking the afternoon off. Mm-hmm. That's for racial sensitivity. Mine would be for cream sensitivity. Close all Dunkin' Donuts for cream sensitivity. Is that possible? I don't know. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. Robert Kersen is here, the great writer, a nonfiction writer, Rocket Men, the daring odyssey of Apollo 8, and the astronauts who made man's first journey to the moon. He's my guest at the big table to talk about this mission in 1968 that preceded, of course, Apollo 11, where astronauts walked on the moon. This was when and a lot of listeners are going to know this, right? My generation just skips this story. I was born in 1974, and space race and space travel culminates in 1969 with the moonwalk, of course, and then Michael Jackson after that. So you can see where there's if a pop star was like, moon orbit, and they did some moon orbit dance, we'd all know Apollo 8. But it's a story I don't know much about, and reading this book, I'm fascinated, and Robert Kersen did a tremendous job telling what he says is the best space story in history. Robert Kersen, my guest, at the big table, 8 o'clock tonight. Also, the new film Book Club is out. The new film starring Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, Candace Bergen, Diane Keaton, Don Johnson. I know, there's a lot. Andy Garcia. Yeah. Craig T. Nelson. There's an Ed Begley Jr. in it. I'm going to keep going. Bill Holderman joins me. He's the co-writer and director of the film. We'll talk about what it takes to get all of those lead actors into an ensemble comedy. They're calling it a mom rom-com, a mom-com. It's a story about women of a certain age getting back into sex, love, and I was going to say rock and roll, but it's not rock and roll. It's more like easy listening. But Book Club, which comes out this week. So we'll talk. Bill Holderman was on the show. We're also going to talk with industry tonight. We're going to talk about mocktails, essentially the idea of craft cocktails without alcohol. Also coming up tonight, Studio 435, Brandon Fox, the pride of Elk Grove Village High School. How about that? We'll be in Studio 435 performing live. And Touche tonight with Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis. Yeah, Veronis in for Roebling. Roebling's one of these guys who I'll send the email saying, what are we going to do, guys? And then an hour later, I go, I'm in Dubai. What? Why did you tell me that? You should have told me that. You didn't tell me that. But Chris Veronis stands by and is ready to take up the Roebling seat. Does that sound good? So that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of stuff tonight. We got a great show lined up. Excited for it. Spent most of the day in Wisconsin. Sad Mother's Day for us, our family, as My grandmother is getting close to passing on, and I feel terrible for my mom and Mother's Day, and she's really taking it hard. My grandmother is in the late stages of dementia. I don't know if I've ever talked about that on the show, but she has been, she's 87 years old, and the time is nearing. You know, she's in hospice, and we went up today to pay last respects, and you know, it's something that's so hard to do for anybody, to walk into a room to talk to somebody who's, you know, about to pass on, and to do so, you know, in the shadow of Mother's Day is even harder. And in the room, she's in a home in Wisconsin, and she has all these pictures up, and it's just great and nostalgic and ironic all at the same time, because, you know, dementia, of course, and Alzheimer's takes away the memory. But when I look around that room today, all I saw were memories. I have memories of me, pictures of me when I was a baby, pictures of me when I was 7 years old in Disneyland, pictures of me when I was 12, stuff that I had forgotten. But I see, you know, a picture with my grandma and my grandpa who's passed, and it brings back nostalgia and it brings back warm memories and love. And to be there in that room experiencing those memories and experiencing that love, and at the same time paying last respect for someone who can no longer do that, it's mind-numbingly mind-numbingly ironic. And it's sad, but at the same time, to celebrate her life and to celebrate all the things that, all the joy and memories and all the good times that she gave me. And that's, I think, what I took away from that visit, was not just to be able to say goodbye and to be in a situation where I could talk to her. She's, you know, she's at a point now where it could be any day, any hour, any minute, and she's not responding to just basic communication. The people in hospice there are wonderful, just absolutely wonderful. And that is a job that is thankless, and a job that is so tremendous. And for anyone who works in the hospice industry needs to know that it's just so much respect. But to be in that situation, to be in that room, and to, I had this moment where I was able to say, "Hey, Grandma, it's Justin," and she turned her head, which was amazing. It's a moment I'll never forget. And again, there's the irony that when dealing with someone with Alzheimer's and dementia, even in the, you know, the last dying days, memories are being made that will forever stay with me. It was a good visit. So here's to my grandma, and you know, hopefully she hangs on, but I also know that the path is paved, so she's ready to go. All right, we'll move on with the download. Sound good? We got a great show lined up tonight, and I wanted to say news, weather, and traffic, as with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout, so stay with us. 708 says, I feel for you, Justin. Lost my mom the same way. Last couple of minutes made me smile and cry at the same time. It's absolutely true. 630 says, I remember going through something similar with my dad after a stroke, praying for your acceptance and grace through this. Talking about my grandma, of course. And then Donna says, I lost my mom on April 29th. She was in hospice as well. You're speaking to my soul. It's true. I mean, and 847 says, let me give you a little advice that worked for me when my stepfather died. I didn't sugarcoat anything. And, dying, it sucks. It's hard. Death sucks. End of the story. It's okay to cry your heart out and respect her and feel that love. Thanks, everybody, for nice thoughts. And I'll just pass it on to my mom. You know, my mom, of course, has taken this pretty hard. And she has done such a wonderful job in the last 10 years or so of dealing with the first diagnosis of Alzheimer's, the transition into dementia, and the phases that go into that, which is just so alarming. And it says so much about, I mean, I could go into, you know, talk show hosts and talk about what dementia is and how it works and its effect, but it is so emotional because as it slips away, it becomes harder and harder, especially for the people who are there every day, loved ones who go, like my mom, and had to be there every day with my grandma. That was very difficult for her, and it's a very difficult time. So a lot of today was about being there for her, but also reliving those memories. Thanks again for all the texts. There's a lot of great texts. All right, let's carry out. All right, here today's top stories. Protests turned ugly in Gaza today as thousands of protesters were injured. 55 allegedly killed after Israeli military pushed back protests against a fence that separates the Israeli and Palestinian border. The protests were organized to push back on the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. Today was the big event to celebrate the opening. The U.S. has backed Israel, saying they have the right to defend themselves and that this is the work of Hamas. Palestinian officials say that the U.S. should condemn Israel for attacking mostly peaceful protests because, well, the U.S. has a long history of supporting such protests. But not anymore. The Palestinians also say that the U.S. silence in this matter is going to give Israel the license to kill. Yikes. Story is continuing. Usually ribbon cuttings are followed by finger sandwiches and tear gas. Or not tear gas, right? Not a good situation. Many conservative analysts believe that the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem will push Palestine to peace. Not a good situation. I was just saying to myself, what is this chaotic 2018 missing? All right, what's missing? All right, an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We haven't had that one of those. What makes this decade full 80s? Let's get one of those going again, right? I swear, if Wendy's brings back Where's the Beef, I'll be convinced we're just living in Westworld. Governor Rauner introduced a mandatory veto today over a gun law, and in doing so added some new wrinkles beyond the 72-hour waiting period for guns. How about something that really doesn't have anything to do with guns, maybe? Instead, death penalty! It's back, baby! The governor wants to reinstate the death penalty to anyone who's found guilty of mass murder or killing police officers. He'd make sure that we didn't go back to wrongfully killing people by changing the entire justice system from reasonable doubt to all doubt. What? Is that a thing you can do? Why didn't we just do that all the time? Is the governor like the Stephen Hawking of lawmakers? Does he see things that we don't? Can he just change court? He can? Awesome. I want him as my lawyer. This is a weird, out-of-nowhere proposal as more and more states are just jettisoning the death penalty because of so many mistakes. The governor and proponents say this move could be one of the ways to curb gun violence instead of gun control, literally put the fear of death in the shooters. This continues to be a national trend as well for state legislatures to make punishment more severe for those who shoot law enforcement. Nobody's going to argue with that, right? But let's just make sure this doesn't end up the same way the last death penalty did. We're putting a moratorium on it, wins you a Nobel Peace Prize. Think about that. The Supreme Court is doubling down on sports betting. They essentially made it legal today. All right, pony up, Pete. $20. I said it was going to be mid-May. You owe me 20. If you don't, I'll break your radio legs. I can't do that anymore? Ah, law. The ruling opens up states to legalize sports betting. This could be a boon for the gaming industry. I think it's fine. I wonder why it wasn't illegal in the first place. Oh, right. Misery and suffering from addicted gamblers who ruin their lives and the lives of their families. Yeah, I guess. Terrible news here. Margot Kidder died. Ugh. It's terrible. She was great. I went back and watched some of those old Christopher Reeve Superman movies just recently. Do they hold up? Not so much. R.I.P. Margot Kidder. In weather, rain all day today, flooding as well, also humid and cold at the same time. Ugh. Sports, the Cubs snuck one in today, actually a rain makeup with the Braves, and well, Cubs wish it got rained out again. The Braves held on 6-5. Man, where'd the Braves come from? Are they seriously at the top of the NL East? They are doing it with a ton of youngsters they acquired over the last couple of years, prospects that are tearing it up in the big leagues. What a concept. The Braves are, what, a game and a half up? The Cubs lose two in a row now, and they're a game and a half back, although another homer for Chris Bryant today, and Yu Darvish expected to come off the DL and pitch tomorrow against Atlanta in Atlanta. What? Man, it's like a playoff series. Okay. Enough Braves already. Let's move on to a different team. Also, Ben Zobrist wore black cleats again today, even though MLB says he has to wear blue cleats. So, drama. The Sox get the day off after a rare win against the Cubs yesterday. They sit at 10-27 on the season. The thought is that Yoan Moncada will be back this week as they head to Pittsburgh. Wouldn't it be great to go on the road and get a couple more wins? Giolito pitched well. Let's keep it going. And let's trade for Manny Machado and bring up all the youngsters, right? Right now. Did I say that out loud? The Bears held their rookie minicamp this weekend. Did anyone get hurt? That's all I care about in minicamps. Anyone? No pectoral tears, no ACLs, no mystery injuries that'll linger for 4 years till they get cut. No? Good? We're good? Good. The big NBA basketball game's on tonight. The Houston Rockets and the Golden State Warriors. Yes. LeBron did his usual get blown out in game one dance yesterday as the Celtics routed him. Been there before, Celtics fans. Watch out. I was ready to call the Bulls a dynasty after we blew out the Miami Heat in game one a few years back. Remember that? I would Taj Gibson dunk on my wall. Postered it. And finally tonight, a new study shows that Americans are suffering from severe depression. It's up 33% since 2013. Does it really matter? Nothing matters. That's the carryout for May 14, 2018. Hey, iodized salt packets are on sale this week. Buy two and get half off. I know they used to be free, but it's 2018. We got to pay the rent. Coming up, Touche. We got Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis. After that, Robert Kirsten's going to join us. Talk about his new film, Rocket. New book, Rocket Man. The new film, Book Club, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
It is time for Touche, Monday night here on The Download. Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis in tonight to spar, get at each other, radio fight, as I say.
Touche. I call Veronis the Chris. Kinder, gentler Chris.
Yeah, you're...
So, someone's got to fill that role.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, don't be too kind and too gentle tonight because we like the fireworks. All right, Dave, why don't we start with the what we have going on in Israel, the protests that have turned very violent on both sides, and you have seen both the United States. What I really want to get at is the United States State Department. Essentially, I mean, they came out today, the communications director came out and said they put this strictly, firmly on Hamas, and that Israel has the right to defend themselves. This is not this normal talk from the U.S. government, but it also usually comes with a dot, 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 but Israel should show constraint or restraint. That part was left off.
Right. Yeah. There is no amount of contempt that I do not show for Bibi Netanyahu. I think Bibi Netanyahu is a liar and a thug and is responsible for a lot of bad stuff. But in this case, the Palestinians were provoking. I mean, they clearly were trying to provoke an incident. They do that a lot. You know, it was only a couple of weeks, not even 2 weeks ago, that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, trotted out every old anti-Semitic canard about how, well, the real reason Jews have been discriminated against is it's their own fault because they're bankers and their social roles and all this other nonsense.
Right.
And here's a big but. The White House has given Bibi Netanyahu carte blanche to do anything he wants. And if you look historically, Israel, which could use an enormous amount of force and kill thousands and thousands of Palestinians when they have these confrontations, never does. Because they always know that the U.S. is out there going like, hey, you know what? You defend yourself, but be careful. And what I heard some Israeli analysts saying today was that they used mortars. They use not just live fire, but wholesale fire. That the number of casualties, there are 55 people killed.
Now CNN says over 58 now.
58 people killed and almost 3,000 injured was because, in my opinion, Bibi is trying to show that he's boss and the U.S. is no longer going to tell him to stop. And in fact, you heard that from the
this all happening on the day that the United States is opening the embassy in Jerusalem. Yeah. That was a controversial move. It comes as a protests are continuing throughout the month about that's leading at, and with the 70th anniversary of the birth of Israel. So there's a lot that goes into this. What do you make of, Chris, the United States and their approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's continuing there?
Well, I mean, there's two issues. One is the moving of the embassy and then how and when you do it. The White House has shown in the past that they're more meat cleaver than they are scalpel about timing, you know, observing the calendar, when to do it, like the day before the 70th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. Moving it, this is an act of Congress. Congress said this is a good thing, and we put it in the president's hand to do it. President Trump campaigned on it, and he followed through on it. And actually, you can criticize him for his policies, but you can't deny that every single thing he promised, he's following through on. Kind of a big deal. You know where this guy stands. Now, I will say, to Dave's point, this does compromise the United States' ability to be an honest broker in the Middle East, something that we've worked really hard to maintain.
It seems like that's been something not just the Obama administration, but the Bush administration previous had worked hard to sort of be the mediator to show that they were at least objective in their negotiations for peace.
Yeah, I mean, look, the U.S. is generally not, quote, is not objective. You know, we definitely have been on Israel's side.
Right.
Not always. Ike, for example, was clearly not a fan and forced Israel to pull back in the 1956 war. And James Baker and George H.W. Bush were very anti-Israel, and it was very uncomfortable for American Jews at that time. However, Trump has just said, thrown all that stuff out the window. And I agree with you on one thing. I think that, Chris, I agree with you. I think that Donald Trump has fulfilled every campaign promise. Or not every campaign promise. A lot of the stuff that's pro-consumer, he is, of course, thrown out, but to serve as corporate overlords. But he has fulfilled every crazy campaign promise that people are like, ah, no, that's just talk. You're not really going to do that. And he's like, oh, no, I'm doing it. I'm doing the crazy. I'm going full crazy. And, I Jerusalem is the capital of the Jewish people and has been for thousands of years. It is the capital of the State of Israel. I've never been comfortable with the embassy, which is in Tel Aviv, when the capital is in Israel. And that said, this is about timing. This is, as Chris said, this is about bargaining chips. This is about if you give away this, which was always held back as the last issue we're going to wind up negotiating because it is so explosive, you basically take this enormous pressure off of Bibi's government to try to actually do something. Now, as a practical matter, there is no peace process today. The peace process is dead. There's nobody on either side.
I'll give Trump somewhat credit in the sense that he said that. He said the peace process, the Palestinians have walked away from it. We're not getting anywhere. So what we used to pull off the table, which was this embassy.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's show that we're serious, that if you're not at the table, there will be punishment to that.
Yeah. Well, over the years, there's been so much stasis and stagnation, but like a kabuki dance, people flirting with the idea that we could get a settlement, and then it falls apart. I think it's completely strategic and reasonable to go down this direction, to put pressure in a place where you haven't before, and use it as a bargaining chip. We'll see. I kind of question if Jared Kushner is the guy to make this happen and bring it all together.
Yeah, it seems to be. It's interesting. But he's been pulled back, and he shows up, and there's a lot of conflict around him.
Well, Jared's sales have been trimmed from everything.
Yeah.
Well, but there's no question we need to go in a different direction.
Yeah. Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy in studio. It's Touche tonight. We'll come back. Let's talk about we're at the one-year anniversary of the Russia probe. We also...
happy anniversary to you.
We talk about Iran as well. It's Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy. It's Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Thank you. go, right?
Miss Touche, Chris Varonis is in for Chris Roebling tonight. Dave Lundy is here. Let's keep going on the international front. We haven't had a chance to really talk about the Iran deal. It happened last week. What do you guys think? Is this good for America that we got out of this deal? That I have a feeling we'll start with you, Chris, because I know what Dave would probably say. But what do you think about this deal?
It's a bad deal, no question about it. In fact, I think it's completely appropriate to pick over the bones of Obama. He didn't go through the historical constitutional process of going to the Senate and getting them to agree on a treaty. In fact, so much of his legacy was by executive action, and now we see it being undone.
That's the danger of doing that by executive action.
Exactly right. Instead of doing the hard work that a chief executive should do, which is lobby members, persuade, marshal public opinion behind him. He didn't do that.
Yeah, he did.
So we have this bad deal. I think it's widely recognized as a bad deal. There's no verification whatsoever.
Not true.
And so
I'm your live fact checker, buddy.
Now we're at this point where Fisher go home. I think for as bad as the deal is, I believe we should have stayed in it. Because right now we have no leverage over the Iranians, none whatsoever. What's stopping them from restarting their nuclear program?
Well, obviously, I mean, David, I'll play devil's advocate to your position that this gives the United States and the European Union to put sanctions on Iran and force them to get out of Syria, to stop messing with Israel, to do things that they couldn't do necessarily with this deal in place.
Well, several things. Not that I want to get into it with you, Justin, but you're wrong, too. Number one, on verification, even General Mattis has said this has remarkably robust verification, better than any previous deal of its kind.
There are military installations that are not.
No, there's one military installation that was at issue, but that's a debatable point. In any event, Mattis and others have said this deal had more teeth. It was not a great deal. I was not a lover of the deal. But the question I always put to my friend Mr. Roebling and every other person on the right who opposed this deal is, okay, you can't go back to the status quo ante. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. The Europeans have said, no, we're moving forward. We're doing deals. Iran is holding up their end of the bargain, so we're not going to throw out this deal. The United States is right now a renegade. We're walking away. We're violating the terms of a deal, even though Iran has not violated the terms of the deal. Now, the question about all the other stuff. Iran is the number one international source sponsor of state terrorism. They're the ones who are behind Hezbollah. They're the ones who are behind Hamas. They've been behind other terrorist organizations. They're in Syria right now. They've developed ballistic missiles. They were developing nuclear weapons. Yeah. Iran is a bad actor. When George W. Bush went after Iraq, I said he's off by a letter. Iran is the one who's actually doing all the things that W. accused Iraq of doing. That said, that is a separate issue. If you're Israel, and I realize that this is controversial based upon what Bibi has said, but I've always been concerned about the existential threat of the state to the state of Israel of Iran having a nuclear weapon, because all it takes is one, and that country is gone. That country is obliterated. It's a tiny, tiny country. I'm going there in August with my family. I can't wait to get back to Israel. But just to put it in perspective, between the Mediterranean and the West Bank is 9 miles. It's shorter than it is for me to get home to Wilmette.
And so what does that have to do with the deal?
It has to do with the deal that that getting rid of the nuclear weapons, even if you're forestalling it for at least 15 years, which this deal did, was better than the alternative. And right now the alternative is, to your point, Chris, they can restart their nuclear program with no consequence. By the way, it's also costing Boeing $20 billion in contracts.
Yeah. Well, I personally think we should have stayed in the deal, but it's completely reasonable for us to get out of the deal. And I don't think the Iranians really care, frankly. They thought this was going to be an economic bonanza for them. It wasn't. And we're not going to get the sanctions regime that we created in the run-up to this agreement, which took years to create.
Yep.
With Europe, the Pacific Rim, even if the United States imposes sanctions, they're still going to trade with Europe and the Pacific Rim. But this is, as we agree, a bad deal. And again, if we agree on our earlier point with Israel, where it's okay to go in a direction that creates pressure, you could argue the same here.
Well, except we don't agree on that. I mean, look, I'm all in favor of creating pressure, but what I'm not in favor of is giving a green light to the government of Iran. And this is the thing. This is what Trump never, ever, ever, ever came up with an answer to. Okay, now what? Now what, and we'll see what happens.
North Korea's win for the president.
Maybe
he gets the hostages or the detainees out. He's got a summit coming up. This is the 1 year anniversary of the Russia probe. Where are we at with this, you guys? I mean, obviously, more and more comes out about Michael Cohen and people that are putting money into him and the FBI investigation into him. But where are we in that? Where are we? Are Americans over the Russia probe already? Do we think we already know that what's in this and what's going to happen?
Yeah, well, I'm one of those Republicans who thinks that this investigation should go on, and but comparatively speaking, with the Iran-Contra or Whitewater, this is nothing. It'll be a year in 2 days.
Those were a lot longer. Yeah,
correct. Exactly.
Whitewater was almost 5 years,
and wow. So.
And that didn't Whitewater essentially turn into Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Which Dave is hoping the same thing happens this time around. But anyway.
No. I think there's plenty of stuff in the original charge. I think there's plenty of stuff on the collusion side.
So I think it should go on. I think some of these indictments are pretty serious. I think there's a lot of people who are in trouble. Paul Manafort, Cohen. And let's see how it plays
out. Last word, Dave Lundy?
I want to know how much money Michael Cohen sent up the chain, paid forward to Donald Trump from these bribes that he got.
Interesting to see. Dave Lundy, Chris Voronis in for Chris Roebling tonight. It's Touche. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the story goes that author and journalist Robert Kersen was visiting the Museum of Science and Industry. After all, he had written a huge book about the U-boat submarine called Shadow Divers, one of the best. But while at the museum, his attention was diverted to an exhibit featuring the Apollo 8 spacecraft. Many know that the Apollo 8 was the first manned mission to the moon in 1968, but what about the details? The intimate details and the lead-up to the famed Apollo 8 mission is told in Kersen's new book, already a bestseller, called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. In it, Kersen talks with the famed astronauts and others surrounding the Apollo 8 mission that culminated in the journey to the moon, and in doing so wrote a tremendous story about ambition, danger, politics, and American spirit. Robert Kersen is an award-winning journalist who used to work at the Sun-Times, and he's in studio with me tonight at the big table. Mr. Kersen, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Justin. Thank you.
Was that an accurate portrayal of that story?
Totally perfect. I could not have done it better myself.
It's interesting because of all the space stories, you talk about the space race and all the things that have happened when it comes to our history with space, you said this is the story to tell.
This, in my mind, is the greatest story of space exploration ever, and I also think it's one of the great exploration stories in the history of mankind. It is, after all, the first time human beings ever left home and the first time we ever arrived at a new world and arrived at our most ancient companion, the moon, which has been calling to us since our evolution.
As someone who knows a lot about history, you've written a lot of great biographies and nonfiction in your life. How much did you know about this story before you embarked on the intimate details?
I knew almost nothing, and that's even after fancying myself a fan of space exploration and the Apollo program. Like so many people, I was much more familiar with Apollo 11, which is the first moon landing, and Apollo 13, in which the crew almost doesn't make it back after an explosion near the moon. So I thought I knew a lot, but as I get older, I realize how much depends on luck and right turns instead of left turns in life. And I took a right turn instead of a left turn in the Museum of Science and Industry and came across this beautiful space capsule that looked, you know, at once to have come from the past and the future. And I knew almost nothing about it. It said Apollo 8 and it said man's first journey to the moon. But beyond that, I knew nothing. I went home, I opened the books and started to read. And within 15 minutes, I knew that I had come across probably the greatest space story of all time.
You're absolutely right in the sense that the Apollo missions, the big ones that everybody is going to gravitate to, Apollo 11, which was the Neil Armstrong to on the moon, the Apollo 13, of course, made famous by the movie with Tom Hanks. But you're absolutely right. This predates that. And this, there wouldn't be those missions without the Apollo 8.
There really wouldn't. And one of the first things that suggested to me that I was dealing with such an incredible story was the way other astronauts, including and especially Neil Armstrong, talked about Apollo 8. Neil Armstrong was on the backup crew for Apollo 8. And when he spoke about it, his voice was reverential. He spoke about Apollo 8 almost as if he considered it to be an even greater leap for mankind than Apollo 11. I had to understand why, and that was really the start of this whole thing.
Well, we'll talk about the story coming up here. You know, for you to write this book, what goes into it? Obviously, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of documented footage and accounts that have been done, but you went and talked to the astronauts. Talk about your process of being able to get their story, a story that has been told, into this book.
Yes, the first thing I did was to check if the crew was still living and where they were. And in fact, they were all living, all three of them. And one of them, Jim Lovell, lived not 15 minutes from me.
He's the famous one that for Illinois.
He was the commander on Apollo 13 from the movie you mentioned with Tom Hanks. So I thought my first job is to get a hold of Jim Lovell if possible. And it turned out that he had been a big fan of my first book, Shadow Divers, the one about the U-boat. And so I had kind of an inside track with him and was able to meet with him. He's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in the world. You always hear that about him, but in person, it's even more true somehow. And once I began talking to him, he called the other two crew members, Frank Borman, who was the commander of Apollo 8, and Bill Anders, who was the youngest member of the team on Apollo 8. And we were off to the races from there.
Jim Lovell, of course, you see his name in everything from the museums, of course, all the different museums, and he comes on media, and he's on WGN radio at different times. But a lot of times, you're right, everyone talks about Apollo 13. There doesn't seem to be much put on Apollo 8, but you know, he had a huge role in what happened with this mission, the one that really was the reason the others happened.
He really did, and even before Apollo 8, he was on two Gemini space flights, including Gemini 7, where he flew with Frank Borman for 14 days in a capsule no bigger than the front half of a Volkswagen Beetle. For 14 days, if you can imagine that. When they came back and stepped on the recovery ship, Lovell said, "I'd like to announce our engagement." So he was always funny, even just back from outer space.
Those guys are really good at quotes at the right time. That's what I picked up from your book, is that, you know, you get this opportunity to speak, whether you're in space in the orbit of the moon or you're about to land or like you just said, coming out of a little cockpit, and they all have the right things to say at the right time.
They really did. They're such intelligent, bright guys. And one of the miracles about the whole NASA era then is that NASA left the speaking to the astronauts. They didn't tell them what to say, didn't screen it. And that part of that would be a huge factor on Apollo 8.
It's amazing. Robert Kersen is in studio tonight. He is the author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. All right, we'll do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll start this story. This story is tremendous, and it's not just about... It's awesome, the details of the actual launch and mission, but the lead up to that, everything that goes into what we know to be the space race, is fascinating. Robert Kersen in studio tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, author Robert Kersen, his book, Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. A fascinating story told by Kersen, a great writer behind the New York Times bestselling author of Shadow Divers. This is already a bestseller as well. This story, is, we talk about the genesis of how you found out about it, but it really is a story as much about space as it is about politics. This was the culmination of what presidents before and said needed to be done to win a space race against the Soviet Union.
That's exactly right. Apollo 8 was conceived really in 4 months' time. When normal space flights would take 12 to 18 months planning, they rushed this to the launch pad. It was for very complex but fascinating reasons, one of which dates back to 1961 when John F. Kennedy made a promise, really an insane promise to the country, that we would land man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade.
And he did that because we were getting our butts kicked by the Soviet Union.
That is exactly right. That is the reason he did it. We were so far behind in the space race. The Soviet Union, our existential mortal enemy, was doing everything first and best in space at the time. And space was considered to be really the final battlefield, the ultimate battlefield. And so there were real existential implications to winning the space race. Kennedy needed something so fantastic, but also something enough into the future that we had a chance to accomplish it before the Soviets. So the idea to land a man on the moon and bring him back was really the perfect thing. The only problem was when he made the promise, NASA had no idea how to do it.
Right.
And so they had 8.5 years to figure it out. So that was one of the motivating forces when Apollo 8 was planned, that we wanted to keep Kennedy's promise to the country. The other was to try to keep the Apollo program moving, because the lunar module, the spidery landing craft used to land men on the moon and bring them back to the orbiting spacecraft, had fallen behind due to production and design problems. So rather than sit there and wait while the space program stalled,
right,
the idea was to send Apollo 8 to do everything but land on the moon.
Up to this point, when we think about the 60s, there are a few successes. There are more failures when you talk about the rockets and the takeoff. There was explosions. There were astronauts who died in some of the missions. It wasn't a done deal that we could get to the moon, let alone land on it. And there was a lot of consternation when it came to this in American space program at the top of it. So talk about, how do you get to a point where, you know, we're not even sure if we can get this done, to, I've got an idea, let's do this quickly.
Right. It still boggles the mind 50 years later how they thought they were going to pull this off so quickly. But a lot of the general concepts were being finalized at the time. Still, there was massive risk undertaken by Apollo 8. And this is what Neil Armstrong talks about when he speaks so reverentially about the flight of Apollo 8. For example, the only rocket powerful enough to deliver men to the moon was the Saturn V.
Mm-hmm.
But the Saturn V had only flown twice, both times unmanned in tests, and it had failed very badly on the second test. So NASA decided that the third flight ever of the Saturn V would not just be manned, but would be 240,000 miles away to the moon.
Right.
The one. And so no man had ever flown on this. So that was just one of myriad risks they were taking. They were also going without the lunar module.
Yes. Now that's a big deal.
Right. A huge deal, because the lunar module, in addition to its primary function of landing men on the moon and bringing them back to the orbiting spacecraft, also served as a backup engine. So if anything went wrong with Apollo 8's primary engine at the moon, if it malfunctioned or didn't fire, they could be trapped in lunar orbit forever, or fly off into eternal solar orbit, or crash into the lunar surface.
And what you say, the irony of Apollo 13 and that amazing, daring rescue or survival of that when the oxygen tanks blew up in space, they were saved by the lunar module.
They're saved by the lunar module.
Which was not in Apollo 8.
No, so if the same thing happened to Apollo 8 as happened to Apollo 13, they'd still be out there.
It's unbelievable to think about. But there was a lot of risk, and, you know, Frank Borman talks about it, and there is this concern that you're breaking protocol, you're cutting corners, all of this for political win. But as we see today, I mean, we're a divided country, and there may be more cynics that would say that this is not the right way to go about it. There wasn't necessarily that chorus, because this country, as divided as it was in the late 60s, the one thing they weren't divided about was space travel.
Right. In fact, people needed something to rally around. 1968, you could argue, was one of the most terrible years in our country's history. You had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. You had violence in the streets, including, of course, here in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. You had 15,000 dead Americans in Vietnam. Often 90% or more of the evening news was dedicated to Vietnam, and you were watching it for the first time unfold. This was an opportunity to watch war, and it was even more horrible than people imagine. Everybody seemed divided against everyone else, and there seemed nothing that could bring this country together by the end of 1968, nothing that could unite us. And yet here these guys pushed this 363-foot rocket out to the launch pad in the very end of 1968 and attempted to fly to the moon for the first time.
It's amazing, because if it fails, if NASA cuts corners and does 4 months training instead of 12 months and doesn't have the lunar module attached to it, which is a backup, if it fails, it could be the end of the space program. It could be a situation where there isn't an appetite anymore to do this, because obviously what you just said about 1968, it wouldn't have been a good end to a pretty terrible year.
People begged NASA not to do this. I reproduce a letter from a man in Connecticut begging them, saying, "We've been through too much now." And, you know, he wasn't the only one concerned. There were millions of people concerned, including the head of NASA himself, James Webb, who, when he first heard the idea for Apollo 8, yelled, didn't say, but yelled, and this is a quote, "Are you out of your mind?" And he listed the myriad risks, including the Saturn V and the going without the backup engine. But he concluded by saying, if these men die on this mission, nobody, lovers, poets, no one, will ever look at the moon the same way again.
Wow.
And that was not just true of the moon. It was true of Christmas, because Apollo 8 was scheduled to orbit the moon on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So imagine if these three American heroes die, who's going to look at the moon or Christmas the same?
It's amazing to think about the risk there. There's so many things that could have gone wrong that aren't just, it wasn't just a normal, like you said, it was Christmas. It's not a normal day. There's so much that was going wrong in that year, yet they went ahead with this. One of the big changes, and this was early in the process, and I forgot who it was, but decided that it was as important to orbit the moon than to land on the moon. The first idea was, hey, we need to get an astronaut to land on the moon, to walk on the moon. But it was someone who came forward and said, you know what, it's as good as landing on the moon as to get into the orbit.
Right. If they could pull off Apollo 8, not only were they going to keep President Kennedy's promise alive, not only were they going to keep advancing the potentially stalled Apollo program, but they also had the chance to beat the Soviets to reach the moon for the first time, the first men to the moon. That was a hugely important step in the space race. But also by doing it, not only would they make those political accomplishments, but they could do and prove almost everything necessary to landing a man on the moon, save for landing the man himself. So they could learn the trajectories and the software, the communications. They could scout landing sites for the future landing
mission.
It
could be almost like a trial run.
It's a trial run. But the thing about it is everything for Apollo 8 is going to be for the first time. And that's what Armstrong and Aldrin and others would say later. By the time others went and landed, Apollo 8 had already proved so much of it could be done. But before Apollo 8 went, no one knew if any of it could be done.
And you have a whole chapter about the Soviet Union and the Soviets' push as well. And it was early December. This was Christmas time, 1968. It was early December where there was pins and needles. There was sweat and, you know, biting fingernails from NASA, from the United States, that the Soviet Union was going to beat us to the moon. There was a window there where they could do it, and we didn't know if they were going to be able to do it or not.
No, not only did we not know, it really looked like they were going to do it in early December. In fact, there were reports out of the Soviet Union that the cosmonauts had reported to the launch pad in Kazakhstan along with the rocket, and they wanted to go. And for reasons that are still not completely understood, they backed down. They had some problems on some previous test flights, but they really were ready to go. And to this day, the remaining cosmonauts are heartsick that they didn't do it and beat the United States to send the first man to
the moon. But you can understand by the story that you tell about Apollo 8 why the Soviets would say, maybe this is a bad idea. Maybe we haven't thought this through.
They were so scared of it and so overwhelmed by the risks taken by Apollo 8 that even after Apollo 8 launched, many in the Soviet Union did not believe that they had actually done it. It wasn't until the flight was well underway that the reality of it started to sink in.
It's an amazing story. Robert Kersen has written the book Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. He's in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break and an update on tonight's news. Come back. More with Robert Kersen here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Robert Kersen. He's the author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. And I'm guilty of this as well. When I think of the man's first journey to the moon, I think one giant step, one small step, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. You don't think about the preceding mission, the Apollo 8, which was to bring a manned mission to the orbit of the moon. And it was done, and it was done in a very risky fashion. One of the other aspects of this book, which is just really tremendous, is the astronaut and cosmonauts as well, in the way, but the way that this country rallied around the heroes that they were, there was a much different distinction of what an astronaut was in 1965 to 1970 than it is today.
Yes, very much. The astronauts of the Gemini and Apollo and Mercury era were beyond rock stars. There were so few of them, and they were doing things no human being had ever done. On top of that, so many of them were very good-looking. They had come from fighter pilot and test pilot backgrounds, so they were very exciting. And they were the bravest of the brave, and they were doing this for our country. And it was a nonviolent thing at the time. We were involved in a war, but they were doing something to explore the universe and to advance science and also to advance our place in society. So it was almost an all-good proposition, and they were beyond the rock stars, as I said. They were just the ultimate in American heroes.
In interviewing the three astronauts, were they aware of that? Do they recognize who they were or what they meant to the country in the space race? And even they had training as fighter pilots and other military training. Did they recognize what they could be and also recognize the risks?
I think so. I mean, it was pretty apparent to them very early on that they had become instant celebrities because they were on the cover of all the magazines in the country. They were each paid $16,000 by Life magazine for exclusive access to their homes and families, and they were recognized everywhere they went. Not all of them embraced the celebrity lifestyle. Frank Borman, for example, was there. He was a military man on a military mission. He believed getting to the moon was only and everything about beating the Soviets. So he could have done without all the celebrity. But they certainly knew what they were getting into, and they came into it all at once. There was no gradual buildup the way you might see in a rock star who gets a little more recognition, a little more. They were instant celebrities, often coming out of complete obscurity. So it was quite a shock to their lifestyle and to their wives' lifestyle as well.
And as you mentioned, the idea at that time, 1968, there's a lot of news. The war in Vietnam, the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. There's a lot going on in 1968, the violence, the protests. This was a televised event. This was something that right at Christmas Eve and Christmas that captured the world. Walter Cronkite, everybody involved to be able to create a moment, a news moment. You could say what you want. I love the fact that at that time, NASA did not have, people, they didn't have spokesperson. They gave this to the astronauts. They read passages from the Bible and spoke to the world in orbit of the moon.
Right. They told Frank Borman, on your third telecast of the four that you're going to be doing on this journey, more people will be listening to you than have ever listened to a human voice at once, nearly a third of the world's population. It's going to happen on Christmas Eve as you orbit the moon. Say something appropriate. And to this day, Frank Borman, who's now 90 years old, laughs at that and thinks, can you imagine that happening today? Today it would go through 16 committees and bureaus and focus groups.
Someone would write it for him.
Someone would write it for them, and it would be screened all the way up to the White House. Instead, NASA told him, do something appropriate, and left it to them.
You're in orbit right now. You've done amazing work, and all of the science and all the things have to go on, and you need to talk to the world.
And it has to be perfect. I mean, this is the first time human beings are going to be speaking to other human beings from another world. And they're going to be speaking to everyone, not just people in the United States, not just people in the Soviet Union, everyone. So it fell to them to do the perfect thing. And nobody ever gave them any guidance, and it was just up to them.
That's amazing. And they were, like I said, if you look at the footage, they're perfect in everything that they say and they do. The other part of this, too, is science. It's amazing the calculations, the trajectories, the flight patterns. There's a great harrowing moment where Jim Lovell puts the wrong numbers that almost destroys the mission as they're on their way back to Earth. It blows my mind at how specific they have to be in their scientific calculations to have success, to the point where if they're off by just a hair, they're dead.
Yes. Bill Anders told me a couple weeks ago, he showed me a wristwatch he had that he said he bought for less than $100. And he said there's more computing power in that wristwatch than was on the entire command module they flew. And in his iPhone, which is, by the way, the latest iteration of the iPhone, there's more computing power than Mission Control had at its entirety. And so with that kind of power and that kind of primitive computing power, they calculated trajectories, distances. They even calculated the time they were supposed to pass behind the moon for the first time when they got there. And they did it to within 1 second of the predicted time they had calculated on the ground.
And you think of all the automation, and you think of watching a rocket take off SpaceX, this happened not too long ago, where the rocket comes down and lands in the right spot, and you're like, what great computers.
Right.
There was a sense of piloting that went into this mission in 1960. When you're trying to land this craft in the Pacific Ocean at a certain spot, if you're just off in your trajectory by a little bit, you're thousands and thousands of miles of where you should be. And it could be days, months, and probably life or death on whether or not you're ever rescued.
Right. And it's not just one thing. It's over and over, many different ways they could make these mistakes through various parts of the mission. Just re-entering the Earth's atmosphere required them hitting an envelope of a width of about 2 degrees, which was the equivalent, they calculated, of throwing a paper airplane into a mail slot from a distance of 4 miles. Anything too shallow, they're going to skip off and they'll be out in the atmosphere with no way to come back. And anything too steep, they're going to burn up and incinerate like a meteorite. They have to hit that mail slot from 4 miles from a paper airplane. Just unthinkable.
And it's unthinkable because what I also took from the book was that NASA couldn't do it any other way. By the rush job, the 4 months, they had enough oxygen for it to hit that envelope. If you bounced off and went back into space, well, that's your oxygen. You're done.
That's it.
There are no safeguards for being off a percent.
No safeguards and no examples of earlier flights that did it wrong or things you could improve upon. As Susan Borman said when she first heard about this flight, everything would be for the first time. Everything. And so that's what makes Apollo 8 so singular and so heroic to so many people who know about it and remember it.
That's a great segue into, you know, my last thought on this is that, you know, so many people, I was born in 1974, but through history and knowing it, and even my father and talking about it, you get an understanding of it. And people in this generation who experienced it, it's life-changing. Where they were, they also the walk of the moon, all the space race stuff is life-changing, life-altering. It's a moment in time. Flash forward to 2018, my son's 10 years old, generations before him, 20, 25 years old. They may not even be looking at the moonwalk as something that was a moment in American history. How do you see space travel and what we have done in the last 20, 30 years changing in the way that it used to? We had this hero worship over these astronauts, and today it seems like it's a private pursuit.
Yeah, it does. I think the only thing that might rekindle that kind of excitement and that kind of joy that people experienced, and it was a joy spread throughout the society. It wasn't limited to kids or boys. It was everybody. I think the only way we're going to get that again is to land man on the moon again and maybe to build a colony there or to send men, and when I say men, I mean human beings, to Mars.
Mars, right.
Mars might be trickier than people, than general public realize, but to do either of these things, you may have to feel that your very existence is threatened again. I think part of what made Apollo possible, maybe most of what made Apollo possible, was this terrible fear that we had. And I think it was a realistic one, that our very existence depended on it, that we were in an existential battle against a great enemy, and we needed to do it. It wasn't just that we wanted to do it or would be a good thing. We had to do it.
There was even a thought that if the Soviet Union beat us to the moon, they could just drop bombs on us whenever they felt like it.
That's what the idea of space was, that if you could put men on the moon, you could put soldiers on the moon. If you could fly satellites in orbit, you could drop bombs from those satellites at any given location you wanted. Sputnik terrified people in 1957. First, it thrilled them. A few days later, they realized this has huge military implications. So our backs really were against the wall, and feeling our existence at stake, I think, really pushed us to do something not just spectacular, but even impossible. And there may be another day, I kind of hope there isn't, where we feel so threatened, but that may be what it takes to do something that spectacular again.
It does feel like politics is a great motivator in the sense that that's really what pushed us to do this. And it's been replaced with this entrepreneurial spirit. You see more people who want to get into privatizing space travel. I mean, is there a way that we can be motivated by the almighty American dollar?
Well, it's starting to look that way. If you watch the launch of Falcon Heavy and seen those retro rockets land themselves, it looked like something out of a science fiction film, then you have to be very grateful for the private entrepreneurs who are putting their money into that, because one of the big problems with government-sponsored space exploration is that it's incredibly expensive. And there's always an argument to divert those funds to something that we could use more immediately here, healthcare or any number of other things. So it's hard to make the case to the American public that we should be spending so many tax dollars. So you have to really be grateful for the entrepreneurs at this point.
After doing this book and of course, all of the touring with it, do you see the space race and the space program in a whole different light?
I do. I think it's even more miraculous than I understood when I first got into it. The minds that were involved and the youth. Frank Borman told me that he believed the average age of the trajectory specialists during Apollo 8 was 24 years old.
Wow.
So to think of the youth involved and that they were all doing this again for the first time ever, and that they got them, they wanted the orbit at 69 miles above the moon, and that's exactly where the orbit ended up. Just incredible. So the respect that I have for the people who pulled this off just grows and grows.
The book is called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. The author, Robert Kersen, journalist and author, used to work here at the Chicago Sun-Times. Robert, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Rob. Join the WGN Radio Walk of Fame ceremony and live broadcast this Friday, May 18th, beginning at 10 a.m. outside the Tribune Tower on Pioneer Court. How great is that? It's already here again. That was one of my great, this is one of my favorite events of the calendar year. All the WGN family, past, present, future.
Mm-hmm.
come on out and celebrate the Walk of Fame inductees. Put the now, I'm not sure. I haven't been in enough of the all staff meetings to know if the old plaques here outside the Tribune Tower, the little, if they just get jackhammered because we're moving.
Yeah.
I could take a day for them to be like, like, you know, do that kind of. That was my jackhammer.
So.
It's also
one.
Like a machine gun. I don't have Rose's machine. You know, he's got that machine with where he's got all the stuff. Yeah, there. Yeah, like that. Yeah, that's there. Yeah, that's a perfect. That's. I have a slow jackhammer. Yeah, but I coming up, we got five inductees. Listen to this. Two prominent Chicago sports personalities, David Kaplan, Chuck Swirsky. How great is that?
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Meteorologist from radio and TV, Roger Treemstra.
Mm-hmm.
An announcer from the golden days of radio, Pierre Andre. A trusted voice in morning drive for over two decades, Mary Vandeville. That's, I'm going to bring a big sign. It just says, go Mary, like a marathon, like she's running a marathon.
Yeah.
You know, we'll, maybe we can draw a cool sign.
Oh, playing favorites right away.
Yeah, right away. Mary's the only one personally. I know David Kaplan a little bit, but Mary Vandeville is the one that I know. So
I'm going to go for Swirsk.
You're going for Swirsk? Yeah, that's cool. But I'm excited. I'm excited for this one. We'll say farewell to the Tribune Tower after nearly six decades of total time calling this historic building our home. So congratulate this fifth class of honorees and come to the Trib Tower this Friday, May 18th, or listen live beginning at 10 a.m. You know what's great about this is I mentioned on Friday I kind of got in a spring cleaning mode, and I took every shirt that I had except the one I'm wearing today,
That's right.
I put it in the dry cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, I'm already mad at myself. I'm picking them up tomorrow. I'm just mad because it's going to be, you know, $60 or something like that, where I'm gonna be like, why did I do this?
Yeah,
I could have easily this out, but instead I'm like, oh, I'm getting things done. Look at me, I'm getting things done. So, but that just means I'm gonna have so many options for shirts this event on Friday. Clean shirts.
You can do a costume change for the, you know,
that's right,
for each inductee.
That's right. I could. I have that many shirts.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. You do a whole denim outfit.
And then after, you can take a picture of each one of them with a different outfit.
That's a great, that's a really complicated but great.
Yeah, I think we can do it.
Idea.
It's supposed to be pretty nice on Friday, too. So, you know, that's always a concern if it's
and
too
I've
hot
got the
or rain.
Yeah, I've got
or
the key card to the bathroom so I can just quickly get in, quickly come out.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I got a new shirt. This one's plaid. The other one was plaid. The other one after that was plaid. So I feel like every shirt that I own, it's just a different variation on plaid.
Maybe we can put some sort of... do they still have phone booths? Maybe we could put some sort of phone booth out there and kind of do it as a bit where you go inside the foot like a Superman.
Superman.
Yeah. You know, rest in peace, Margot Kidder.
Yeah, right. Learn about more of this year's inductees at WGNradio.com/Walk of Fame. We got a thunderstorm warning that's just coming across right now. There's been a lot tonight, but it kind of already came through in the commute. You know, there's obviously up and down with thunderstorm warnings. This is for Kendall and Kane counties coming up here starting in now and essentially for the next 30 to 45 minutes. So that's coming up as well. On the show coming up here, excited, Bill Holderman's going to join us. He is the co-writer and director of the new film Book Club. This is the film with Jane Fonda and Mary Steenburgen and Candace Bergen, Diane Keaton.
That's a cast.
We'll talk with him about the film, which comes out this week, and what he had to do to work with so many lead actors. It's an ensemble movie. These four women, they have their own book club, and they all have their own storylines when they come together. But how do you have your first movie that you direct? The first one, and you're a young kid, you're like, oh, man, here it comes. I'm so excited. My directorial debut. And I go knock on the trailers, and it's Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, Candace Bergen, and Diane Keaton. I'd be so intimidated.
Yeah.
You can't make, well, one, first moment, you're like, I forgot to put tape in the film. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to be filming this camera, and I messed up. I think about it. The lighting was in the wrong place. My bad. So we'll talk with them coming up here. Also, industry night, we're going to talk about Top Note Tonics, idea of mixers and mocktails and the resurgence of healthier options when it comes to soft drinks. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Coming up, Bill Holderman's going to talk about the new film Book Club. He co-wrote, directed the film, starring Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, Candice Bergen, and Diane Keaton. Talk about his directorial debut, and those are the stars that he needs to put in the right place. Good luck to you. It's time for Industry Night, our Monday night dive into the world of food and hospitality. Last week, we talked about the James Beard Awards and how Chicago got hosed. This week, let's talk tonic. My guest tonight spent a majority of her life in craft beer, but recognizing that market to be saturated and overcrowded, Mary Pelletieri turned her attention to soft drinks. We all know that the options for soft drinks are limited. You got your sodas, your teas, your lemonades, or your lemonade teas, or your tea sodas. And keep going with this variation. But the same attention to detail that goes both into craft beers and craft cocktails has had a harder time crossing over to the consumer. Enter Mary, who co-founded and is president of Top Note Tonics. Top Note has had a great couple of years. The Milwaukee-based company has won awards for their tonic and ginger beers, and it's found in many of the cocktails in your favorite Chicago restaurants like Avec, Longman and Eagle, and The Whistler, just to name a few. Mary Pelletieri with Top Note Tonics in studio tonight on Download. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So let's first, how did you, I mean, the crossover to go from craft beers to soft drinks doesn't seem like a natural one. How did that happen?
Well, you know, craft beer, I was in it at the beginning and had watched the innovation happen, watched craft brewers go from thinking about English style ales all the way through the Belgian style beers to really their own innovations now. And I kind of saw nothing really happening in the soft drink industry. The large companies are attempting to innovate, but really where innovation is going to happen is out of small, really entrepreneurial companies. So I saw Top Note as an opportunity for me to play in a space where I thought a brewer might have fun, which is in tonic, which is traditionally just a bitter soda.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't seem like something that a lot of people have turned their attention to because it is traditionally a bitter soda. It's not something that people put a lot of energy or passion into. Talk about tonic itself.
Well, tonic is a real traditional beverage. I mean, pre-prohibition, we were... even in the United States, drinking tonic as a category beverage, say a sarsaparilla soda, you can get as a tonic and you would add bitters. And it was really great for digestion. So we kind of fell away from that after prohibition, kind of figuring out just the whole idea of bitter in our drinks kind of fell away after prohibition. It was more of a European tradition anyway. Mm-hmm. But as Campari and Aperol and some of these other real bitter liqueurs have started to kind of have a revival, as have tonics, and tonic as a mixer is being used more and more. And I saw 10 years ago now bars and restaurants starting to make their own tonic because they just couldn't find good brands of tonic out there that were interesting or had good enough ingredients.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, tonic falls into the gun at the bar,
mm-hmm.
where
so right.
you hit the left side and you get Diet Coke, and you hit the right side and you get tonic. But there always seemed to be not a lot of emphasis put on the mixers, especially when you're talking about mixed drinks in bars.
Yeah, well, the mixer used to, I mean, Coca-Cola became a mixer during Prohibition because there was bad booze. and it blended out the bad booze flavor. So mixers, you know, to hide the bad liquor had been, you know, something out there. But the liquor category has gotten better. Spirits are becoming crafted.
Yeah.
Not just the premium side, but there are much more smaller producers out there now making very high-end, really well constructed flavors and beverages and just very different things. So why not have a mixer that actually complements versus hides it?
And that's so interesting because I wouldn't know what ingredients go into tonics. When you talk about making craft tonic, What goes into that? How are you doing that? Because I can think of the ingredients that go into beer, and I can think about liquor because the stories have been well told. But when you're talking about craft tonic, mm-hmm. what is tonic?
Well, crafting anything, we're really crafting a soft drink. But I, you know, when I was at Goose Island, we made the soft drinks there. And I was on the quality side, so I was doing all the R&D.
And those great soft drinks.
And I had a lot of fun with that project. I understood a little bit more about the sweeteners that you can use. There's different types of acids that you can use. Just like anything, you can find high-quality ingredients, or you can go for a lower-quality ingredient, depending on your cost structure. So I knew there was an opportunity out there in botanical extracts. Those were something that we're seeing more and more in the soft drink industry. And there's better quality ingredients are now being available now, are really available for soft drink makers. So why not craft in the tonic yeah. spectrum? And I also thought bitters themselves just needed to be looked at from more of a botanical or craft brewer mentality. There's a lot of things that can bitter in beverage, and that of course has a history, right? We have vermouth, which is really just a bitter wine. We've got bitter liqueurs that have different bitters in them. So why not use different bitters in the soft drink category too?
It blows my mind to think about too, because I would think, especially when you're talking about tonics, that is an ingredient for something else.
Yeah.
In the way that, you know, that I wouldn't think necessarily all the stuff you were just mentioning, botanicals and extracts, that would go into actually making tonics. I just think it's tonics being part of an ingredient for something else.
Well, tonic is really, all soft drinks originally were just botanical beverages. You know, originally, even what we see as cola was really a lot of botanicals mixed together. And created, they flavored mineral water, you know, and that's what soft drinks used to be, or syrups that flavored mineral water. Well, tonic, again, was the thing that toned the body. It was good for digestion, and it had bitters. So we went back to some of those original recipes, and we not only use quinine, which is kind of traditionally now what we think of tonic because of the Brits and the gin and tonic, but quinine is not the only bitter we use. We use actual bitters that you find in things like bitter liqueurs. Mm-hmm. So our tonics have a little bit different bitter spectrum on them. And then, you know, we also innovated in the ginger beer category. Ginger beer is just a robust ginger ale. It used to be re-fermented in the bottle.
Right.
We just decided to use a darker sugar and use a little bit more of an earthy flavor. So it comes off very different. And they all have very different mixable qualities. And I see the mixing category and just something that people at home are going to want to play a little bit more in, and we'll keep giving them some good stuff.
Well, let's continue the conversation. Mary Pelletier is here. She's a longtime brewer and the co-founder and president of Top Note Tonics. We're talking about tonics and mixers and really looking at that part of the soft drink and bringing the craft idea to soft drinks here in our Industry Night segment here on The Download. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Mary here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Mary Pelletier is in studio. She's my guest tonight in our Industry Night segment we do every Monday night here. We're talking about craft tonics, really. I mean, craft soft drinks. Mm-hmm. Because not just tonics, you also have ginger beer as well. It's an interesting departure from what we know to be craft cocktails or craft beer. We've seen such an explosion in those areas, but not as much in the soft drink area. For you to have a background in brewing, to understand craft beer, you talked about your time at Goose Island. How much of this is science? How much of this is, being a professional who understands how these different elements come together? How much of it is creativity? And how much is just driven by taste?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. There's a ton of science. I don't actually know it all, but I do know what I like, and I do know good flavor. So 20-some years in the brewing industry, you taste a few beers, you get an understanding of balance. And that was something I thought was missing in the mixer category. So that's why we focused on this alcohol-adjacent category, in which we're making soft drinks that are made to be mixed with alcohol. They don't have to be mixed with alcohol, though. We were talking actually in the break about non-alcoholic beverages, and they actually make a nice base for a non-alc as well. But balance had to be there. So I knew bitter, sour, and sweet had to be balanced. So I used you know, some of the tricks that you learn as you're making beer on how to do that, and also just use a lot of trial and error and tasting.
I always been told, and this is why, you know, for, you know, the idea of tonic having sugar, like mm-hmm. a lot of sugar in it, that you think that maybe because it's clear, you're thinking, oh, I'm being healthy right. in my drinking. But there is a lot of sugar. So how do you deal with that? Because that seems, we seem to be entering a phase in today's world in 2018 where people are very conscientious about how much sugar they're putting into their beverages or craft.
And they should be. There's a lot of alcohol that actually has extra sugar in it too. So I always coach folks on asking their bartender how much simple sugar they're putting in their drink, if they're using a mixer, how much of the mixer they're using, if it's a high calorie mixer or not. We actually made these specifically with about a mid calorie a weight of sugars, so about half the sugar that you'd find in a standard soft drink. We always know a good bartender is going to balance the drink no matter what. If they need to add a little element of sugar, they might add a little bar spoon of sherry or some liqueur if they want to do that. But let the bartender do that, or let yourself do that at home. Mm-hmm. You could always mix a drier drink, and if you need to add just a little more sugar, you can. But good spirits don't need to be hidden by sugar. So that was the premise of starting these out with a lower sugar platform, because, again, yes, the tonic that you traditionally see on the soda gun, which
masking, right.
is masking some of the badder spirits out there, but good tonic, which actually you're starting to find ours as well as some other brands on the soda gun, so don't think it's all bad. You can find some good natural sugar tonics that are going to be mid-calorie, not only in bottles, but now on the soda gun as well.
That's interesting. I was at a restaurant this weekend. It's the first time I had seen a cocktail menu, where they had a non-alcoholic section within five or six cocktails. They were not mm-hmm. sort of your standard, you know, seltzer water. It was, these were mixed as if with several ingredients. They just were missing the alcohol. This is a trend that we're seeing more and more, that more people want to experience that cocktail, that mixed drink that is just sweeping restaurants worldwide. But some people don't drink. So you're seeing more and more of this. Is this a good thing? Is that a good balance? I mean, are they the same in the sense that if alcohol is removed from these things, they still are great drinks?
Yeah, well, I guess that shows you that there's creativity and craftsmanship without the spirit there, without the alcohol part. And I think that's a good bartender is going to recognize that there's going to be folks that actually want the experience, want to see some of what the bartender's doing, making their drink, maybe without a spirit, which is fine. There's actually quite a good movement here in Chicago where you're seeing more of that, where there's spirit-free or alcohol-free components to the menu. And we like that because they're going to be looking for good mixer yeah. brands to bring to the table to help out with that.
As someone who's been in the industry as long as you have, and you talked about the 20 years in craft, and whether that be beer or soft drinks or just the industry, are you amazed at how much the customer has evolved when it comes to their palate, to their understanding of mixed drinks? Because you probably have seen where even in craft beer, yeah. people are like, I'll take the yellow one. Like, you know, that you've seen more and more customers are educated about what's in their drinks or what these things are and what it's going to taste like before asking educated questions to their bartender.
Well, I think the whole food movement has been about knowing more about where it's coming from, right? So the whole artisanal movement that extends from craft beer to wine to spirits to soft drinks to, you know, farm to fork kind of thing at the chef's table. People want to know the authenticity of the story. They want to know what is in this. And yeah, I think there is that element to just about everything now. So why not ask it of the mixers that are being used?
When I think about this, and you've got three of them in front of me, a bitter lemon tonic, Indian tonic water, and ginger beer. And you said that these are primarily soft drinks for mixing spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're selling to consumers? The idea that you should buy these and mix your drinks at home if you're doing mm-hmm. More specialty stuff? Or how are you approaching consumers?
We're approaching
these to bartenders,
classic highball mixers. So, you know, replace your generic tonic with a bitter lemon, and you're just going to have that much better of a gin and tonic or vodka tonic experience. in Europe, they drink bitter lemons as a soft drink. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that. That's actually my favorite. The bitter lemon here has taken off. Soho House picked it up, and we've actually had a couple bars and restaurants go there and pick it up from there. So it's just a really nice soft drink. It's got a little bitterness. I think when we explain to folks, we sell these as mixers, and we say they are meant to be mixed, but people say, well, I kind of like it on its own. Yeah, I said, that's great. You know, go ahead and drink it on its own. And that's actually a category of soft drinks in Europe for that reason. But we're a little slow to the take right now in the States. Let's take it one step at a time.
How do you convince, like you mentioned, Soho House or Vec or these any restaurant that's serving cocktails to maybe move up a price point for a product or to do something that gets them out of what they used to think as a category that they didn't have to spend money on?
You know, the price doesn't come out to that much more per cocktail. And a good bar manager is going to look at what they're spending and the consumer experience. And it's not even a consideration at the better places. Right. They're already going to be buying, and many times they're already buying another soft beverage from maybe over in Europe, and we're taking that place. So as a domestic, so the better ones are already serving some really great stuff. We're just going to give the Europeans a little competition.
There you go, Mary Pelletieri, the co-founder and president of Top Note Tonics. Top Note Tonics can be found in restaurants like Avec, Longman and Eagle, The Whistler, Soho House, just to name a few. Mary, can't thank you enough for coming in to educate us on all things tonic and mixers and soft drinks here on our Industry Night segment.
Hey, it was fun. Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on Friday, the film Book Club comes out in Chicago theaters. The film follows four women and their romantic pursuits, whether it's love, sex, or relationships, finding love in an older age, rekindling love, or just even working through the adult relationship between a mother and her kids. The cast is frankly amazing. Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen, Mary Steenburgen, Diane Keaton. My next guest job was to contain all that star power, the man who wrote and directed Book Club, Bill Holderman. Holderman, well known for his work as a producer in Hollywood, but this is his directorial debut. He's in studio right now. Bill, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I don't know what it was. I really enjoyed the film, and we got to the end. I'm like, how would one direct all of this star power? Because even the supporting cast is all leads. It's leads everywhere you look in Book Club.
Yeah, there's a lot. I will say there was a lot of star power. The one thing that was amazing, though, given all of that history and all of that star power, they were all incredible to work with. They were so respectful of the script, so respectful of me, respectful of each other. And I think part of it was they're so used to being maybe the only star or one two. And I think they were all kind of trying to make sure that they were not going to be the problem child. So they were all on their best behavior, and they were incredible.
It really is a great ensemble, and even the male parts as well. And like I said, they all could be leads. They have been leads in their history. For a first-time director, how intimidating was it to work with people who have carried their own films?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is the challenge was to get them in the film. So that process where you had to go sit down and go sit down and sort of convince them that they should take a chance on a first-time filmmaker. That was more intimidating. Once we got them on set, we'd gone through so much work of working and collaborating on the script and just talking about the characters that the on-set part, and you're so busy when you're making a movie at this pace that, like, you don't have time to be intimidated.
Right. And you wrote this film as well. You wrote this script. Talk about, you know, it is a film that is about romantic relationships after a certain age. For you, you're here in studio with me, young guy who, as you talk about writing a script that is playing to a certain demographic about a certain age, how do you do that as someone who's not part of that demographic?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, and I co-wrote it with Aaron Sims, one of the things that we really were sort of focused on was to make sure that the stories themselves were really grounded and really human. And we always looked at it as the themes were ageless and timeless. It wasn't specific to this demographic. I think people have a false sense of once you get to a certain age, you sort of, you know, everything, and everything kind of smooths out and the obstacles disappear in relationships. And it's just not the case. And so the truth is the themes that and the things that these characters are encountering are the same things that you encounter when you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s and beyond. So it was pretty natural just to keep it grounded and keep it human.
Can you have a script when you're writing a script that is about finding or relationships and relationship troubles or finding new love at a certain age? Can you start by just telling the real stories about finding it and then add the ages later?
I mean, we wrote this very specifically for this cast. And the way this came up, truth be told, and this is the embarrassing story that has gone a little bit public, but I was sending my mother the 50 Shades trilogy for Mother's Day. And I was working with Aaron at the time, and she thought that was ridiculous, because it is. And then we started talking about our mothers, and she ended up sending it to her mother and her stepmother.
Interesting, yeah.
That same day. So Mother's Day, these books went out, and then we start talking about our mothers, and they're all of a certain age, and they're all kind of going through their own journeys in life, and they have very different sort of outlooks. And so when we came in to start writing the script, we never thought about it for any other demographic. We wrote the original draft. Diane's name in the script was Diane because we wrote it for Diane Keaton. Jane's name in that original draft was Jane because we wrote it for Jane Fonda. Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you?
So we never really considered anyone else. But yeah, I mean, I think when you're writing for that age or any age, it's you just try to make sure that it's truthful.
The big plot point in the film is that they are book club, and they do each month they pick a different book, and this month it's 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
That's humorous in its own right, but there's something great because it unlocks everyone's kind of view of sex and romance, some who are more uptight about it, some that are looser about it. But it starts this journey, and it really comes out of just reading a simple book. Is that the premise? Do I get that right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think that culturally and certainly in Hollywood, there's so much ageism and there's so much sort of belief that at a certain age that you're just no longer relevant. So we loved the idea of bringing in this book, which really did catch the zeitgeist and really did have a cultural impact, and bringing this book into a group and letting that sort of permeate their core and challenge who they were and where they were in their lives. And I think, you know, it's a titillating book, and it got them out of their comfort zone.
What I loved about the film and what resonated for me watching it was this chase, and it's a universal story, but it's also this chase for happiness.
Yeah.
And it resonates because it's not just about someone of a certain age. It's everywhere. Like you said, it could be any age. But there really is like a great, when you think about the relationship, the Mary Steenburgen relationship, and what it takes to be happy and to chase happiness. And mm-hmm. it seems like it's different levels of that happening in this film.
Yeah. I mean, it's about chasing happiness. It's also about sort of believing in your own self-worth and believing that sort of your time and the love that you have to give, there's someone out there that wants to receive it, and there's someone out there that may want to share theirs with you. And I think that pursuit of happiness, I mean, it's, you know, that is universal. And I think we all are trying to figure out our journeys, and on the way, you know, it's a lot more fun when you're enjoying it.
Yeah, absolutely. In studio with me tonight, Bill Holderman. He is the director and co-writer of the film Book Club, which is out in theaters on Friday. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation here on The Download. So stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking with Bill Holderman. He's the director and co-writer of the film Book Club, which is out in theaters this weekend. The cast is just amazing. Jane Fonda, Candice Bergen, Mary Steenburgen, Diane Keaton. Almost on purpose, I'm not even mentioning the men. They also, as well, a great cast. It is interesting because you mentioned at one point this concept of there is ageism in Hollywood. And you hear this all the time about, you know, finding roles for women as they get older in Hollywood. Hollywood is notorious for this, where people age out and they don't want these roles anymore. So it's refreshing to see scripts where you can have such tremendous actors. And no disrespect whatsoever to the script and to the film, but it may be a different film without this talent.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think for sure. And they don't see scripts written for them very often when it's just one role. And the fact that we had four roles that all had their own full sort of arcs was, I think, really appealing to them. The other thing that's amazing is Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Candice Bergen, Mary Steenburgen never worked together before. So a huge appeal for them was to all be in the same film and all sort of get to know each other. And one of the things that we didn't anticipate but we hoped was the genuine friendship that was born from just coming in, doing the roles, but in between takes, I mean, the stories that they could tell history that they, I mean, they've been movie stars for decades and decades. So, you know, that's a pretty unique existence, but there you have four of them able to share those same sort of tales and tribulations.
As a director, and I noticed this while watching the film, you have to be able to weave the tales of these four women and their pursuits of love, sex, romance, happiness. because they're so powerful on screen as an ensemble, you want to get back to Jane Fonda. You want to get back to Candice Bergen. They're electric and magnetic in that form. Is there a little bit more pressure in the editing room or as a director to make sure that each one of these story arcs that the characters are in has enough screen time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, number one, we worked really, really hard on the script. But once you have that foundation and then you end up casting, you know, actors of this caliber, you really want to do right by them. And so that interweaving and making sure that each storyline gets its due and each actor feels like they signed on for the movie for a good reason and are happy with the result. I mean, that was pressure from script level, that was pressure on set, and it was certainly pressure in the editing room. The great thing, again, was when all of them were together, it was an incredibly sort of electric and dynamic setting because they were having so much fun and they're all such gifted comedians and could ad-lib and have, I mean, just make it supernatural. Yeah. But when they're all on their own, I mean, they're paired with incredible co-stars. And I think that really helped us make sure that we had a storyline for each of them that you wanted to go back to.
Yeah, it really is tremendous and it's exciting. And I think part of the reason that the film works, of course, the script and everything that goes in, but there is a relationship that I have with those actresses, with all four of them and movies they've been in before, that you are both comforted that they are in these roles and you're also curious on how they're going to play them out, if that makes sense, because they have had such strong careers and you've found attachments to them as someone who is a moviegoer.
Yeah, I mean, they're each in their own right iconic, and we certainly played upon that and wanted to sort of use that because you do have a relationship and you do have, you know, as a moviegoing audience that has seen them over the years evolve, it's you want to have those touch points and that connection. And it's really important too for the actors. I mean, you want them to feel really comfortable wearing those characters. And for us, it was shades away from who they are in the real world. So that was kind of a blessing.
It defies demographics, but it will play to a certain demographic in the theater. You're going to get seniors who come out and want to be able to watch the film with their favorite stars, but also it's a storyline for seniors and it's about romantic interests at a certain age. How do you approach that? Do you have a hand in the marketing of this? Do you try to work with the people whose job it is to be like, hey, don't go overboard in that regard. This is for everybody, but I see the value in what you're
doing. I mean, certainly they're based on the cast and based on the subject matter. There's a core audience that is being targeted. But the thing that we've seen through the early screenings are, and it's interesting, the younger people that have seen it and are responding really positively, they're almost like, there's a little bit of an embarrassment, like, I can't believe how much I loved it because I'm only, you know, I'm only 30, I'm only 28. Right. But that's been, for us, really gratifying to see that it is, you know, going beyond what is the obvious core audience. And, you know, it's a great film to see with a group of friends. And we've seen that happen, too, where, you know, a group of people, men and women, go. And I think it's the type of film that you're going to leave and feel good. And that works no matter how old you are.
That's a great point about you and this being your first film that you've directed. That idea of leaving the theater feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of ways this film could have gone. And there's a lot of places where people could probably check out and say, I'm not invested in this character. I don't like the character that Candice Bergen plays or whatever it might be. But there is this way in this film that towards the end, and you get to the end where their storylines are completed, that you do feel good coming out of the theater. You do feel satisfied. How important is that for you as a scriptwriter and a director to have that arc, to have people coming out of the theater feeling a certain way?
Yeah, well, seeing as I want to work again in the business, it's really important that people leave the theater feeling good. And particularly, you know, there's tremendous amount of pressure as a first-time filmmaker because, you know, not every first-time filmmaker gets to be a second-time filmmaker. And that audience satisfaction is essential. And it's one of the things that, truthfully, from the script level, I've been really cognizant of and make sure that the audience experience was never forgotten. Yeah. And I think sometimes for first-time filmmakers, you forget how important that relationship is, that audience to what's going on screen. And for me, that was always in my mind because I wanted people at the end of the day to leave the theater with a smile on their face and hopefully, you know, knock on wood, we achieve that.
What did you learn from this experience? What from this experience do you take with you in your career as you start thinking about your next film and your next film and your next film?
Yeah, well, certainly cast really great actors is a pretty good start for any filmmaker first or whether you have a ton of films under your belt. You know, the thing that was so interesting to me on the journey of this was was just that the dynamics amongst the cast. And one of the things that we did that not all films do, but I brought the lead actresses into the casting process. So everyone that they played opposite of, because they've had, the thing is, you know, all of these actors, they know everyone in town. They've had experiences, some good, some bad. You learn that. But to bring them into the casting process and make sure the people they're playing opposite of are people that they want to be there with.
Yeah, right.
Because at the end of the day, I mean, it is a job, but if they're there having a good time with their friend, it makes it a lot better. And I think for me, I will always make a cognizant choice to have the dynamics amongst the cast be as sort of, I don't know, just natural as possible.
That's so interesting. Bill Holderman's my guest tonight. His film Book Club is out in theaters on Friday, starring Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen, Mary Steenburgen, Diane Keaton, among many others. His first film, Bill Holderman, can't thank you enough for stopping by and being on the download tonight.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Looks like the Golden State Warriors got a nice little lead, but who knows, man? When it's Houston Rockets and the Golden State Warriors, game one of the Western Conference Finals, NBA. Mm-hmm. It's the game we've been waiting for, right?
It's going to be a good series, yeah, I think.
I better be.
Yeah. Well,
tomorrow is the draft lotto. The balls that will be in Chicago for some reason. That's where they're doing this, where all the representatives, the GMs, and the former players get together to hope that they get the lotto ball to bounce their way. Is this where they will sometimes, I remember this from when we were kids, and I don't know if they still do this, where if they get the number one pick, they show who it's going to be already. Like they show like, didn't they do that where they like almost flipped a little cardboard and it was like a jersey of O'Neal, you know, for Orlando or something like that? They already.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I feel like they did that. Maybe it was just video games.
Maybe you guys can help me out here. What was the name of the woman who used to do the lottery drawing?
Linda Kohlmeier.
Linda Kohlmeier. Thank
now,
you.
She would be great.
Right.
They should get her
out
to do the NBA draft lottery.
What a great idea.
Right?
And here's your. Here's your NBA draft lotto.
She was just always so bubbly.
She was so good. She was the best.
She was really good.
She was the best. We had a whole. I had a whole love affair with her, and not in real life.
Yeah, right.
No, I just mean that I would watch the 9 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news just for her.
Yeah, the way she's like spun. It was like a story.
Yeah, she was so good at it.
I saw somebody tweet, and it was for a different team, but it could apply for the Bulls. I'm going to say it as it's the Bulls. This person tweeted, "You're not going to believe me, but it's true. The Rockets and Warriors play the same sport as the Bulls."
Yeah, I know, right? It's hard to watch, and these guys are just amazing athletes, and they play in the same game in the same league as the Chicago Bulls. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live performance Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio in beautiful Michigan Avenue. The rain's starting to fall. Tonight, we welcome Chicago artist Brandon Fox, the R&B pop soul artist. Just put out a new album called Remedy. And for this album, Fox is raising awareness for mental illness by donating the proceeds to Mental Health America. The album charting on iTunes, and Brandon Fox, the pride of Elk Grove Village, in studio tonight. Brandon Fox, welcome to the Studio 435.
What's up, Justin, man? Thank you for having me.
No,
I'm sorry I brought the rain with.
Trust me, it's already here. Great to have you. Thanks, and congrats on the success of the album charting.
That's awesome.
And thank you. Why don't we start? I mean, I kind of said the pride of Elk Grove Village, but I was reading an article today that you were in choir there. So let's, before we get into hearing music and everything, talk about your roots in music, where it comes from, and how you got to where you're at right now.
Yeah, for sure. So my musical journey, I don't know, I mean, I started kind of going to church regularly, you know, listening to the choir and whatnot, and then my parents, they would always be playing music, you know, James Brown, Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, you know. So I think it all started there. I always liked playing and performing. My parents would like film us during like Christmases and stuff, and we'd do like little talent shows. So I've always been singing, but if I'm trying to think like back, Boys to Men a lot. Mm-hmm. And then growing up from there was like Craig David. There was Usher, you know, things like that.
Well, it's interesting, yeah. Because that sound, and we'll get to what your sound is, and we'll obviously hear some of that sound. But when I say R&B pop soul artist, what takes you there? Because when I hear your music, and the album is great, it's very Thank pop you. In the way that I could hear that on B96. I could hear it on you know, top 40 radio. It's got that vibe. And not every band that comes through here is a band that has that kind of sound. So yeah, yeah. When you think about where you want your career to be, are you thinking about a career that would be charting right now on iTunes, but charting in a way that you're like names that you just mentioned, Usher and company?
Yeah, I mean, well, when we were creating the album, it took a while. I want to say it took over 2 years to complete. But the beginning stages was kind of figuring out sonically the story that I wanted to tell and the music that was behind it. You know, so I first started writing songs, and it was like everything that you'd hear on the radio, I guess. You know, I was trying to like fit into that trend, and yeah. It was difficult, you know, at first, because I was just talking about regular stuff as far as like, oh, going out, you know, trying to get this girl, going out to the club, you know, drinking, partying, like all that basic stuff that, you know, you hear. So once we kind of just dug deep, and I had a conversation with my manager, and he was just like, you know, you got a story to tell. And like as soon as he told me that, I went home one day and I wrote Glory. And for, you know, whatever reason, it just clicked. And like writing that down, it was like therapy to me. But then in the same sense, like it just happened so fast. Like it was like I wasn't even putting any effort into it.
Yeah.
You know, and then like the chorus just came out, the glory, hallelujah. It just came out. And then from there we just took off, man. So from there we wrote Bring Me Down, and everything was just personal, you know. There was a lot of stuff that I had to get, you know, honest, you know, and just be really transparent. But, you know, through that, you know, a lot has happened. And I mean, from what I've heard from everyone around, they're really liking the album. So
well,
I'm just
when you
grateful.
Talk about your personal story and making an effort to be honest, you know, you have a lot of pain and heartache, and as mentioned, you're raising awareness for mental illness because you've had that in your family and yourself, and
right on.
Substance abuse is I mean, there's a lot of stuff that a lot of people spend a lot of time covering up.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to musicians and people who are going to be in the limelight. So it's one thing to say, yeah, I'm going to be more honest. I'm not going to talk about partying and chasing girls anymore. But it's another to say, I'm going to bring up some of the issues that are brought up in your music.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing for me. You know, it's funny because like, I've always been one to really not talk about my problems or my family's problems, or my family even would be like, you know, like that's some stuff that we just keep to your family. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are the same
Absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, man. People listening right now, yeah.
Yeah, so for when I decided to actually do it again, it was almost therapeutic for me. You know, like I just felt this release come off of me. And then just to get the love and support from everyone as soon as I started doing that. And, oh, you don't know how much you've helped me, and I've been going through this. And it was just all positive, you know. And that's when I knew that, okay, we're in the right direction. You know, we're doing something that is greater than myself. You know, and it's, music has allowed me to provide this platform, which is something that I never dreamed of. But, you know, I'm living my dream every day.
It is interesting because it's not just, you know, therapeutic for you, because if you look at the Twitter responses and people reaching out in different places, and you talk about dealing with depression or dealing with mental illness or dealing with substance abuse in any form, and you're talking about your personal journey or your family's journey, it's the responses. It's the fact, like I just talked about just earlier in the show, I talked about my grandmother's going through dementia and she's about to pass on.
Yeah,
the amount of text that came in, not saying thoughts and prayers or that, but people saying, I know exactly what you're going through because I'm going through it, because yeah. I'm connecting to you right now because I just had to do that. My mom just passed away,
right.
Whatever it might be, is where the power of connection comes from. That's the relatability. And in music, for a century, I mean, that has been really what it's about, the connecting emotionally. So for you and to have that powerful story and a lot of stuff that is on the record that you're singing about,
mm-hmm.
there, it's really about not just your own therapy, but the way that you're being able to relate and connect to others.
Yeah. I mean, I always think like once I put music out there, it's no longer like mine. It's everyone else's, you know, because I've put so much effort and stuff and listening to it back and forth and, oh, this is wrong, this is right. But yeah, I mean, once I put it out there, I feel like my work is done. Now it's time for people to really absorb and take it in for what it's worth. So a lot of times when I'll write music, I won't even tell the listener, you know, what it's about.
Right.
Specifically, it's more of like how you interpret it, because I want it to help you in whatever way, whatever you're going through. Right, right. So definitely.
Brandon Fox in studio, the R&B pop soul artist, just put out a new album called Remedy. For this album, Fox is raising awareness for mental illness by donating the proceeds to Mental Health America. The album, like I said earlier, charting on iTunes. Brandon Fox in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. More conversation and live music coming up here on Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Studio 435 here on The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Brandon Fox is in studio, the R&B pop soul artist. Just put out a new album called Remedy, which is charting on iTunes. The pride of Elk Grove Village in studio tonight. I read this old Daily Herald piece about you coming back to the choir to sing with them. This is last year at some point. But it reminded me that a lot of musicians get an opportunity to get their start playing in bands, playing in choir, and really at the high school level. Talk about how important it was for you as a musician to have that experience.
It was probably like one of the more gratifying things that I've ever been a part of, and it's just opened my eyes to so much. It was wild because what happened is I ended up like getting fired from a job, and I was just so salty about the situation. I remember I was commuting back home and I was like, man, what am I gonna do? And I just remember, like, you know, just hearing like, go, you know, go talk to these kids. And I know, like, I feel like it was a higher power telling me that. And I reached out to one of my buddies. I knew he was in like a dean of some school in the district, but I come to find out he was a dean of my alma mater, which is Elk Grove High School. So I reached out to him and he was like, yeah, we could have you come speak actually next Friday. We have a pep rally. The whole school's going to be there. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Hold up. Like, it got real quick. And I was like, what am I going to talk about? Right. Yeah. But it was cool, man. You know, I ended up going out there and I went to practice with the choir because they wanted to be involved. And when I was in high school, I was a part of the choir. So it was just really cool to go back there and to see the students and to see the staff and whatnot. And from there, the choir sang with me when I performed, and we've just been in touch this entire time. And that kind of started things for me. So I've been speaking at schools ever since, and just talking to the kids about, you know, believing in themselves, chasing their dreams. And then obviously I touch on mental health, you know, bipolar disorder, alcoholism, depression. So yeah, there's a few things that I talk about, but all in all, man, it's just really grateful to be able to talk and to be able to perform, and then afterwards, you know, being able to talk to those students, you know. And again, a lot of them are going through similar situations at home that I was never in that position growing up. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, if I could reach one person, you know, to just stay positive and, you know, yeah, believe in themselves, but to still understand that, hey, there's stuff. You're going to go through a lot of things in life. A lot of times it's going to go left when you don't want it to go that way. But as long as you stay
especially
focused.
Especially if you're in the arts, right?
Right, yeah. If you stay focused, you believe in yourself, you can achieve anything. So, I mean, you know, I played Lollapalooza. I've done some big things. You know, I was in a previous band. But when I go out and I speak to these kids and I perform, there's like not a better feeling. Definitely.
It's such an interesting place for you, because as an artist and a young artist, to be a spokesperson, to be a motivational speaker, to talk to young people about mental health, depression, bipolar, a lot of times you're going to get those speeches from people who are older.
Yeah.
They're going to come in their 40s and 50s, and they're going to say, I was there, I lived in a van down by the river, you know, that old thing, right?
Right on.
So for you to be a young guy who, you know, is up and coming, like I said, charting on iTunes and yeah, talking about your album as an R&B pop and soul singer, you know, is it easier to relate that way, that people see who may be like, I'm depressed, or I might have bipolar disorder, and I can't believe that Brandon is talking about the same things I am? I mean, there has to be more relatability because you're closer in age.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, again, I had no idea. This is me just stepping out there and saying, all right, let's see what this is like. But yeah, as soon as I did it the first time, there were a lot of schools that reached out to me, and they were just like, you know, we'd love to have you come in and, you're talking from a different perspective. You know, you're younger. You're going to be able to identify with these kids. And then not only that, being able to perform too, so they see it too, you know, and it's just not me talking, and I don't want to be too boring with them. So I'll incorporate playing live music and singing along and having the kids get involved. And yeah, man, it's just something. It's awesome.
Where's that come from? Because, you know, you do the choir, but you're also a football player.
Yeah.
I mean, you played football. Yeah, right, I mean, you went to college for football. I mean, you really are living dual lives in the way that not too often are you going to get former football players coming on stage singing and dancing and talking about mental health. I mean that there is. I mean, it's talk about how you blend that all together as an artist and that background to do what you do.
Yeah, it was like I was always chasing two different dreams, but I never wanted to stop one to pursue just one. You know, I wanted to keep the options open. So through high school, I went to college based off, like, they came out, Carthage College came out to see me play a few times, and they liked the way I play, so they gave me some grants and whatnot. So I ended up going to school there. While I'm playing football, I'm progressing, so I started as a freshman. I'm an All-American as a sophomore. I think things are taking off, but also I wanted to do music, so one of my best friends, his roommate was always jamming. So I was like, yeah, let me get involved. What can I do? I sing. Yo, what's up? What's up? Let's jam. And then he was like, all right. So we started playing, and I was playing like the tambourine and the shaker, just whatever I could to be involved. You know what I mean? So we started playing at this local spot out in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the crowd just started coming out crazy. We play there every Thursday. And we started packing the place, and then from there we moved back to Chicago after we graduated. We all grabbed electronic instruments, we added a drummer, added a bass, and we called ourselves Makeshift Prodigy.
That's the band that played Lollapalooza, right?
Yeah, you got it. So yeah, things took off from there. We ended up signing with Atlantic Records. We toured the country for a couple of years.
What was it like for you to go from playing tambourine on your thigh, man, to being signed by Atlantic Records?
It really happened so fast that I look back now and I'm like, wow, dude, you were signed to Atlantic Records. Like, I look back and I mean, it amazes me, but at the same time, I always knew that I wanted to at one point, like, speak my message, or, you know what I mean? Like be a front man in the same sense, you know what I mean? So, after a couple of years of touring and getting into too many fights with band members, and then just I felt like the label wasn't doing as much as they could as well, so I was like, all right, let me branch off. So I started doing like EDM music. I remember performing at Wavefront and Spring Awakening with some of the Chicago DJs, and then from there I started working on my stuff, you know, just R&B, pop, soul,
it's back to the original. It's so interesting, and we're going to hear some of it, but to because you have members of your band in studio tonight, Rocky Ropo and Christian Kwiatkowski is here. It's interesting because the music that I didn't know that about the EDM part. I didn't know that you were doing Spring Awakening and stuff.
I didn't
pick that up in the research. So to hear that and know the music and how it's produced and the sort of dance element of what you're doing, that's the part that attracted me, because I was like, that's such an interesting, I don't see a lot of bands bringing that element to indie or alternative music, because, or even R&B,
we wanted to bring back like that feel good. You know how like you wait like on the weekends and your mom's like got the music loud and she's cleaning up and you smell the breakfast cooking. You know what I mean? Like just that feel good music. Like we wanted to go back there and get, like I'm speaking about a lot of real stuff. There's a lot of substance in that album. But sonically, that sound, it's still got like that warm feeling. There's a lot of horns that are involved, you know, there's upbeat drums and whatnot. So, we wanted to definitely not follow the trend. We wanted to stand out. And again, I think it's doing great right now.
Well, one of our favorites, Taylor Bennett, on the song Glory.
Yes.
And you've done stuff with him as well. He's a favorite here in the Download. Brandon Fox in studio tonight, the R&B pop soul artist. His new album Remedy is charting on iTunes. The Pride of Elk Grove Village in studio tonight. Brandon Fox, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we'll hear some live music. Studio 435, stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Brandon Fox is in Studio 435 tonight. The R&B pop soul artist. It's a new album called Remedy. is raising awareness for mental health by donating the proceeds of the From Remedy to Mental Health America. The album charting on iTunes. Brandon Fox in studio tonight. Here he is, Rocky Ropo and Christian Kwiatkowski, also Rocky on drums, Christian on guitar. Here is Brandon Fox and the track Bring Me Down. Take it away, guys.
WGN Studios. Yeah, yeah. We go like this.
Set the party for a late night. Fast forward, move time for the late bite. No home cooking meals from my mommy, but I'm kind of lit. Hit the deli, hot cheese and salami, yummy. Flow cold like a sweater. I'll be your umbrella. Hold you down in any weather. And if you're my fire, then I'm your core. Hey, I ride for you. Take on all the mountains I climb for you. Staring at the stars, busting clouds, I high with you. Butterfly loving girl, I die for you. Cause they holding me back, holding me back, holding me back from you. But a matter of fact, got a counterattack. No, they can't hold me back from you. Nobody gon'
down. The name of the track, Brandon Fox, in studio tonight. The R&B pop soul artist, along with Rocky Ropo and Christian Kwiatkowski. Christian on the guitar, Rocky on the drums. The track, Bring Me Down, the album Remedy. Brandon Fox, come on, take a seat again. Come on down over here. Live in studio. That was great. Wow. I feel like we're... I don't know, man. I'm always blown away by Bob Ferguson and what he can put together out of this showcase studio. That was amazing.
We're able to see him.
But this amazing performance. For you guys, talk about the band. I mean, for you to go solo, but to be in a position like you are here in the studio, talk about what it's like to play this music live.
Man, I've always, like I was telling you before, like something about performing, but like playing live... being able, I feel like when you go out to shows, it's to bring people together, you know, through your talent, through whatever you're displaying. So I've always taken like so much pride into performing live and just putting on hopefully a one of a kind experience, so they can go home and just be like, wow, I was so glad I was able to experience that. So it's funny with Rocky. As soon as I decided to go solo, I was like, I reached out on Facebook and I was like, who knows a live drummer? And instantly one of my friends hit me up and was like, she tagged his name. And I hit him up. He came and jammed with us, and he's been 5, 6, 7 years. Now with Christian, he used to play in Makeshift Prodigy. So it was just a matter of, you know, networking, talking to him. Hey, what are you up to, man? You know, you want to be a part of this? And there was times where he was going through some stuff, you know, where he wasn't able to fully commit, and totally understandable. But I'm so thankful, so grateful to have them here, man, just because I feel like without them, without having live instruments provided, it takes a little bit out of that live performance. So I want to try to display and give out as much as possible. So when people are watching, like, man, that dude's really dope on drums, or that guy's awesome on guitar.
When you're putting something, when you're putting this type of music together, does what comes first? Does the music come first, where the band's all together and you guys are jamming? Does the track come first? Does the live performance come first? Talk about the experience of writing the music and putting it together.
It's always started with me through music. As soon as I feel like I've caught something that I could vibe out to, that's when the writing process gets involved. So it's like the track first. Once I feel like it's something that stands out, then it goes to writing. And then from there, we bring in the live instrumentation. Like, okay, this is what the drums laid out look like. What can we add, you know, to make it even better than what it is right now? You know what I mean? And with Christian, I usually just let him do whatever he wants. And I'm like, all right, man, just don't mess it up, right?
Christian, come sit down for just a second. I have a question just about, you know, the live instrumentation on, you know, when you're talking about R&B music or pop or dance music, you know, even the EDM stuff where there's a produced track. As a musician, as a guitar player, what's your focus? What are you looking just to riff off of what's in front of you? How do you see yourself interacting with the music that's produced? Come up on that mic, yeah.
It was a big adjustment first and foremost to try to figure out how to play with R&B music and try to make what he does sound even better. I don't know. I think my approach on it is Brandon did a real good job with the record in general, so he made my job way easier.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
For you, but where do you come? What's the background? What's the usual background for guitarists? For you, what music did you come up with? What's the most comfortable?
I grew up on a lot of blues, which is helpful for this, but I was all over the place. I did metal music to more top 40 stuff to folk music, so I try being well-rounded, so this definitely helps.
So what about this music is challenging? When you say it's R&B, what is it from a guitar standpoint that makes it challenging?
I mean, every guitarist just wants to play, overplay. This is one of those moments where it's like, slow down. Slow down, play less. Just make it, you know, just making it sound appropriate.
Yeah, there's been a few of those conversations where I'm like, just don't play. Just don't play then.
Don't play.
Patience. I learned a lot of patience.
Well, it's great music. The album is called Remedy. It's out now on iTunes. It's charting. Brandon Fox is a Chicago artist, R&B, pop, and soul, and also Rocky Ropa on the drums, Christian Kotowski on the guitar. Let's take a break, our last break of the night. We'll come back. We'll do one more track, if that's good by you guys. We'll continue with Studio 435. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Studio 435 tonight here on The Download on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Brandon Fox is in studio, the R&B pop soul artist. His album's Remedy. It's charting on iTunes. He's giving all of the proceeds to raise awareness for mental health and donating all those proceeds to Mental Health America. We'll talk quickly about that right at the end of the hour here. But let's get one more live song tonight here in Studio 435. Here is Brandon with Rocky Ropa on the drums and Christian Kotowski on the guitar. Here is the track Lose It All. Take it away, guys.
Inebriate the problem, you solve it till you're fat line. Body shaking like a broken dryer. You sick of feeling for the liquor, but I know you see the light. I'll be going crazy.
But Brenda had a baby. Change your life, we all need love. My mama taught me don't play. Truth reveals when things ain't your way. Higher power praises Sunday. New beginning start on Monday. For the night, temptation on the other end. She said I could do you right. Quicksand and I'm sinking, but it's too much to lose. Nothing left that I got to prove. Though I'm curious, but my love and trust, I got a happy home. So much noise, lost my voice. Brand new day, brand new boy. I wish I knew I was playing much a mule. Lesson I learned was teaching me not to bet. But it's what you're chasing. Life throws curves, but we gotta face them. Oh, 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 oh,
I mean, appreciate you guys.
Yeah, there we go. Brandon Fox in studio 435 tonight. All right. There we go. All right. There we go. Rocky Ropo on drums, Christian Kwiatkowski on guitar, and the Brandon Fox, the album's called Remedy. And, you know, before we let you go, Brandon, I'm going to get you back on the table real quick.
Yeah.
You are you are donating these proceeds to Mental Health America. And I just want to read a text that came in that just said, I just watched Brandon's YouTube video about his work with Mental Health America. His words really resonate with me from a personal experience and helps us struggling with such issues to feel more comfortable and accepted and cared about. I just want to thank him so much for being another voice raising awareness. It takes courage to speak about mental illness, but it also removes the stigma.
Amazing.
As you release this record and you give all the proceeds away for what you're doing and trying to raise awareness to mental health and mental illness, what do those kind of texts mean to you as somebody who is bearing it all?
Everything. Like I was saying before, it wasn't until like I went out and I spoke at a school and I got done speaking, and then I was out in the foyer and I was talking to some of the students, and this young lady, this young girl was a student. She came up to me and was just like, you know, thank you so much for, you know, what you're doing. You know, I deal with issues myself and I've been bullied a lot. And I was just like, oh, like, wow, thank you so much for doing that. And it started to hit me that this is like bigger than the music. You know, like there's people that are just really struggling out there and that, you know, don't really have an avenue, or they don't have somebody to talk to. I should say there's always an avenue, but for some people it's a lot easier to just keep it inside, you know, and to let that stuff build up. And then the parents came over and then they started talking to me and they were just like, really, like, thank you. And the hair on my neck, the back of my neck, just stood up, and like I got like teary-eyed, and I was just like, oh my god. And like that's when it hit me that like, okay, we're doing something to try to create a legacy. You know, it's like, I feel like you can't do that until you start doing things that are not for yourself, you know, and you gotta think of other people first. And when we created the album, we were like, okay, and I was talking with my manager about this, and we were like, all right, what else can we do, you know, to spread awareness about this. And I talked about, you know, putting together like a suicide prevention show, and reaching out to some sponsors through that. And then we just came about like, no, we're going to donate the whole entire album proceeds. And we started talking to a few different people. Mental Health America, they stood out. They were just amazing people front to back. And we put out a mental health awareness video, which is doing great. And the reception that I received on that is just more than words, man. I'm really, really thankful. Thank you so much. I mean, everybody that's sent out texts, that sent out messages, and students, just it really, really means so, so much to me. I can't thank you enough, for real.
Chicago artist Brandon Fox in studio tonight. The album's called Remedy. The proceeds go to mental health awareness through Mental Health America. The other guys in the band, Rocky Ropo, Christian Kwiatkowski, thanks for performing. Brandon, great to meet you, and thanks for being here.
It was a pleasure. Let's do it again soon.